This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, Joint Terrorism Task Force and Lockheed Martin to surveil workers calling for $15 an hour and full-time work.
But first, Holly Okuno is a founder and co-director of Cooperative Jackson, an emerging network of worker cooperatives and supporting institutions in Jackson, Mississippi. Holly also served as the co-director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, the executive director of the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, based in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and some of his most noted works, all of which I have read carefully, as should you. Recently, Casting Shadows, Chokwe Lumumba, and the Struggle for Racial Justice and Economic Democracy in Jackson, Mississippi, Revolutionary Nationalism for the 21st Century, and Until We Win Black Labor and Liberation in the Disposable Era. Holly Okuno joins us from Paris and the Climate Summit.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, first of all, you're there with a coalition of groups, and what made it imperative for you from Jackson, Mississippi, to head to the Paris Climate Talks? What's the correlation between what's happening there and issues on the ground for democracy and development here for the working class?
Just to give the audience some contextualization, I was planning on being here as far back as 2013, and was looking forward to being here to represent the administration of Chokwe Lumumba and our efforts at making Jackson the most sustainable city in the Southeast, if not the United States and the world. We had designed a fairly comprehensive program on how to make our city a zero emissions and a zero waste city by 2025. That was part of the Jackson Rising vision that was key to our administration's program, but also to the campaign program that got Chokwe elected. So me being here and Cooperation Jackson being here really has been in the making for some time. We've been traveling with like-minded comrades through the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, through the Climate Justice Alliance, in the Intex Roots delegation of which we are part of, where we call the Freedom Road from Jackson to Paris contingent of the It Takes Roots to Weather the Storm delegation. But we've been members of the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance for almost 10 years, and we recently became an Our Power pilot site in 2014, this being Cooperation Jackson. So we're here really fulfilling a long-term strategic aim and objective. I mean, we just want people in the audience to really understand that.
Maybe you can also just give us a sense of some of the ambiance that is occurring generally in relationship to the climate talks amongst the populations of people that are in Paris now.
It's very different than what I think we were hoping for, just to be honest. Since the events of November 13th, that tragedy, the conversation has shifted profoundly. There's much more of a conversation around security and climate change than we would have hoped and liked, because it shifts the dynamics, it shifts the focus, it shifts the onus of energy and attention, and quite frankly, the resources. We are experiencing a very heavy police and military presence at all of the events, at all of the kind of historic sites of Paris. So you get a different feel of the city, of the negotiations, and I think we were anticipating it being a much more open, democratic, and expressive space as we were planning on being here for well over, like I said, in some cases, almost 3 years. So it shifted some things, and what you're finding and what we're finding, the voice of the social movements have been muted, basically, to this point. And we're searching for all the cracks and crevices we can to make our voice heard, to get our message across against the kind of repression and the stifling of dissent that the state has basically ordered. We're experimenting. Groups are trying to figure out a number of different things. There have been small protests every single day, and we're just trying to figure out ways to get them amplified, one of which is, you know, talking to yourselves and to the audience back at home to let them know that folks are still trying to resist and still trying to figure it out and still challenging, you know, the quote-unquote official negotiations that are taking place. And and the false solutions that are coming out of the COP 21.
Kali, what is an agenda for power for working and poor people and communities of color at these talks, whether it's, of course, coalescing amongst other people similar to yourselves, or whether or not it's influencing or both the talks that are going on amongst the 190 representatives from government?
Well, there's a number of different strategies that organizations within the Eat Cakes Roots delegation are exploring. Some folks are inside trying to battle there, and they're going over all the wording of the official document and fighting for things that would assert our values, our vision, give us some protection, alter some things. There are a number of people who are doing that. But the vast majority of us are really working within the civil society space and in the broad social movement space. And there, we're trying to educate the broader public about what's going on, about how bad the deal that's being constructed is, how it's going to have an impact on their lives and on the lives of their children and grandchildren, and that we have to stop it and what we can do to stop it. That's the primary thing that we've been really focusing on. In the present context, you know, we're doing a lot of art, creating public art to get people kind of shooken up a little bit, or just made aware that things are going on, what's being decided. There are innovative demonstration, flash mobs and things of that nature that are kind of taking place, and still some attempts at doing some demonstration. So all those different things are going on. But we're really starting to shift gears to a certain extent on thinking about what is really going to happen and needs to happen, because we know what's coming out of here at this point is going to be terrible. It's going to burn the planet, literally. And we have to figure out how to put the onus of the change back in the hands of the people and develop a strategy and a program that's going to actually build real concrete alternatives like we're trying to do in Jackson, Mississippi. But at the same time, we have to challenge the powers of the state. We have to challenge the power of the corporations and capital to make them be not only accountable, which is the first step, but to move towards systems change. It comes in the forms of reparations, technology transfers, changing how they do business, not just in terms of clean, but reappropriating a lot of those resources and funds so they're distributed equally to those that need them, communities on the front lines and the different peoples and countries in Africa, Asia, Oceania, and Latin America. So these are some of the things that we're really trying to build a broad international social movement here on out to really advance the fight back action if needed.
And further, just elaborate, and we should say, just in case there are some people earlier who didn't know, that Chokwe Lumumba was elected a mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, and regrettably died prematurely and did enormous things and had enormous vision down in the South with his regime, which people like Kali continue. Tell us what you think a climate justice agenda would be in the aftermath of the talks that you bring back to this country. And, of course, one of the things that I am still very critical of the quote-unquote progressive movement here is that issues of environmental racism and so on have not really been brought to the fore as part of our agenda. But what do you see as strategic when you return to this country for us to continue to work on?
Well, you started with number one on our agenda, which is tackling environmental racism. I mean, that's number one. If that's not really dealt with, what's going to wind up happening is them shifting more and more of the problem onto Black, Latino, and other oppressed communities. That's just a political reality. If we don't face it, that's what's going to happen in both the short and the midterm. So we got to confront that and make it a top priority. I would say number two on the agenda is we have to really focus and fight on the oil companies and the other kind of power companies. We have to shift to zero emissions immediately within the United States. We have to make a hard case and a serious fight to do that. So imagine the tar sands times 100, that fight. That's what we basically need. So they need to keep it in the ground. And we all need to invest in the alternatives, solar, thermal, and other forms of energy which are within our grasp, which can be made affordable if the investment and the political will was there. The resources exist, the political will does not. So we have to really focus in on that. Then I think some of the more practical things that we can do on about a local level is really fight for a just transition program. The one that we've been innovating in Jackson really focuses on getting our city to become a zero emission city in 10 years and a zero waste city in 10 years. And to do this in such a manner which creates jobs for our people in the community, not only in just things like solar thermal installation and repair, but you got weatherization, you got new methods of construction to rebuild the infrastructure that's needed. You can take all the different waste products and create industries off of that, from composting to new forms of manufacturing with the recycled materials. So we're looking at it not only as just fighting climate change, but we're also fighting the impoverishment of our people at the same time. That's Cooperation Jackson's core mission, and that's part of the core mission of the Climate Justice Alliance and the Our Power campaign. So those are the three things that I would really highlight to our audience and to our audience in the United States that we need to focus on.
Colleen, would you also say that looking at the fossil fuel economy as a driver of multifaceted crises around the world is a significant issue for the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance and the various progressive organizations that have come to these climate talks?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the key slogans, particularly of PGA and the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, is no war, no warming. And we understand that a large part of the imperial conquest of the last 10 years, if not longer, but definitely the last, since the Bush administration, have only been about water resources and, more importantly, oil resources in North Africa. And we see that program continuing now. And then you have the boom of the fracking industry in the United States, which really expanded to really undermine some progressive governments, particularly Venezuela and some others. So there's a direct link to the promotion of war and to the destruction of our own communities and things in our backyard that are really fostered and driven by the petrochemical industry, which is why we got to tackle it and basically get it to cease as an industry, which is why we're focusing on that second piece that I mentioned, which is keeping it on the ground. So these are core things that this entire alliance has agreed upon and is trying to focus on developing effective and winning strategies on a local, on a national, and even an international basis.
So the alliance links together. That's meaningful. That's progressive. This has to be an international movement. What is, for you, the takeaway, particularly in terms of some of the cynicism that you've expressed about what the global powers are going to recognize from these climate talks? What is the takeaway for us?
If I can, I don't see it necessarily as cynicism. I see it as, as telling the truth to our people and to not promote false hope and false solutions. And the sooner we can come to grips with the truth of what's happening is that, you know, these corporations and the nation states are in complete collusion and agreement on burning the planet. They're putting profits over people. That is their agenda. And as soon as we come to grips with that and develop a program and a strategy to fight back and to create the alternative, I think the better we will be. We have to save ourselves. They're not going to do it. I mean, that's not why I came here. I don't believe that's why most of the forces that are part of our alliance are coming to try to convince people that this negotiation is going to save us. After 20 years of ongoing talks and failure after failure, I think we have to kind of recognize that they have just kind of created a negotiations industry, and mainly it's Western Europe and the United States that are just kind of dragging this process along so they can continue doing what they're doing. So we need to clearly educate people and to demonstrate through action they don't intend on changing unless we force them to change, and we have to build the strength to force that change. And in the meantime, we also have to build the concrete alternatives on the ground in our communities so that when the change inevitably comes, we are in a position to dictate how that's going to look, who is going to serve, and not have the corporations do that for.
Colleen Okuno, we're going to insist that you rejoin us when you're back in the States, and we want to pick up on more of what's happening down in Jackson, Mississippi, and the work that you're doing as founder and co-director of Cooperation Jackson. You have some of the most creative, incisive ideas. The reality of what we just skimmed the surface of, talking about environmental racism, is of strategic importance to build in to our movement for climate justice. And thank you so much for this brief understanding of the work that you're doing down there, and we'll continue and we'll pick up on it when you return to the States.
Looking forward to it.
And we've been speaking with Colleen Okuno.
Madagascar, Congo River Basin, California, Norway and Brazil, land across our planet, both tropical and temperate, with sacred rainforests that clean up all the air. Far away over here, trees clean up our atmosphere. We breathe in, they breathe out, something we can't live without. Southeast Asia, Chile and New Zealand, Tanzania, Niger and Gabon.
Hayes Greenfield, music for a green planet. Who would have thought, really, who would have thought that Walmart was engaging in FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force and Lockheed Martin contracted with to surveil workers who are merely calling for a $15 an hour wage and full-time work? Well, we're going to find out a lot more about that now with Dan Schlegelman, co-director of Our Walmart. And let's just begin. Wait a minute. Lockheed Martin surveilling workers fighting for decent conditions. First of all, thank you for being with us. And do tell us what in the world is going on and how it was uncovered. Who wants to begin?
So the background is this. So in 2013, Walmart workers around the country went on prolonged unfair labor practice strikes where they got on buses and rode across the country and ended up at Walmart's annual shareholder meeting with an event that was called the Ride for Respect. After those workers completed the Ride for Respect and went back to work, Walmart began to illegally terminate and discipline workers who engaged in that. And that case went in front of the National Labor Relations Board, the federal government, and the government ruled that Walmart had violated those workers' rights. And so as a part of that, there's been a hearing going on where Walmart was required to give over documents related to that. It was in those documents where we found that Walmart talked about how they were partnering with the FBI Terrorism Task Force and about how they had an ongoing contract with Lockheed Martin.
Just to expand on that just for a second before we really get into it, the Lockheed Martin was doing the surveillance. What was the FBI doing?
At this point, it's still unclear. We're going to be gathering and requesting documents to find out exactly what they were doing. But the way the documents referenced it was they were looking at them as part of the FBI around the work we were doing around Walmart's annual shareholder meeting, where striking workers were talking about the issues that they were facing and about how they were being retaliated against for speaking up about raising wages and conditions at Walmart.
Tell us more about how this came to light.
This came to light because Our Walmart, the organization that Walmart workers are building, is challenging Walmart like never before. And, you know, things that Walmart, you know, normally would just get away with and wouldn't be exposed, Our Walmart has been able to shine light on it and show that, you know, this is the kind of way that Walmart treats and thinks about its own employees. You know, the part that struck me a lot about the Lockheed Martin piece was that the person who they were coordinating with, Lockheed Martin, you know, he had a tagline under his name, and it was a Latin saying, and, you know, a lot of us will have different, you know, different taglines under our name, Gandhi quotes or Martin Luther King quotes. His was a Latin phrase that said, if you want peace, prepare for war. And so the fact that Walmart would be asking people who, you know, have that kind of a philosophy to be tracking their employees just really speaks volumes as to the way that Walmart really thinks about their own workforce, who, you know, our long-term employees who are just trying to make the company a better place, who are trying to put food on their table, who are trying to take care of their kids, who are trying to, you know, make sure that they've got a chance for a better future. And so it really is an incredible development.
And the consequences of the tracking by Walmart, Lockheed, and possibly the FBI of these employees who are just protesting for better pay and working conditions in many cases was they were fired and disciplined. Is that correct?
Yeah, for the workers who were on the Ride for Respect Over 70 of them were either fired or disciplined illegally, and that's the case that currently the government is hearing against Walmart, and we're hoping to get a decision on that case sometime in early 2016.
Do you find it surprising that a multi-billion-dollar corporation actually feels the need, aside from the outrage of the spying itself, that it would actually feel the need to spy on its own employees just to stop them from earning essentially a better life?
I mean, I wish I could say that it was surprising. I mean, I think for the amount of times that workers have said to me or said to organizers or said to leaders of our Walmart, that Walmart is watching them, this is certainly, a reminder of that. But again, I just think it's also a reminder how afraid Walmart is of our Walmart. I mean, this organization, is being built by Walmart workers across the country. It's, challenging the company like it's never been before. The company has, given 500,000 workers a raise as a result of the work of the organization, has put billions of dollars into the hands of its lowest paid employees. And so, the organization is having a huge impact on the company. And so I think the company is, rather than doing the right thing as a resource and as the people who are helping this company make the hundreds of billions of dollars that they make every year, it's treating them like an enemy. Our Walmart is both going to continue on and it's never going to go away. And it's, Walmart's better off taking the resources that they're wasting, really putting it into work of making the company a better place for its workers.
Has there been any response from anybody in the federal government, either legislative or executive, as to the role of the FBI in this?
Well, we are going to be launching a petition in a big way a number of the committees that oversee the FBI, and those members, and we're going to be asking them to weigh in on this. We've had conversations with a number of elected officials who have been aghast by this and have committed to help us understand more and, help us to end this practice is happening. So all of that is underway. I mean, getting the story out there was step one, and, we're now going to be running a full campaign to shine a bigger light on this.
Dan, what did they actually do? What methodology? Was this phone tapping? Was this opening mail? Was this trailing people? All of the above? I mean, I'm really interested. I mean, Lockheed Martin, one of the lucrative corporations in the world, in conjunction with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, what a terrifying abuse of a public trust, among other things. But how did they actually surveil these people? Do you have any direct information on that?
I mean, we really just have these glimpses of information. I mean, again, under the discovery of the hearing, Walmart was required to turn over huge amounts of documents. And our sense is, I mean, we just don't know, but if we were to speculate, our speculation is that these documents kind of slipped through the cracks, that made the references to the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force and then as well as relationship to Lockheed Martin. We didn't get a lot of other documents under the testimony that Karen Casey gave in front of the federal government on this. She acted as if it was, a matter of fact. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary for the way the company operates. Just treated as if it was just the way they operate.
And she's the labor relations director there at Walmart.
She was the head. Yeah, that's right. She was the head of labor relations. She's now moved on to sort of a different part of the company, but at that point she was the head of their labor relations.
You know, what fascinates me in all of this is Les Lockheed Martin, who one might guess had a private contract, or one wonders, were they enlisted by the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force? But the kind of collusion and using that may be there, but using a body like the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force for a private corporation to surveil its workers is just absolutely unconscionable and staggering and frightening that the government would undertake such a task. So what does this mean about, so those of us who use the term plutocracy, does it mean that Walmart runs the government? Well, to some degrees, with Citizens United and other things, we understand the monies that are poured into electoral politics by these corporations. But how do you politically begin to look at, and what is our Walmart going to do on one level about just the public component of that, the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force? Is there litigation planned? Is there an appeal, aside from the petition, to the Department of Justice and the Obama administration?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're looking at all those questions. I think, we want to get a better understanding of what was happening, what still may be happening or may not be happening, happen any further, because, our Walmart is not engaging in any kind of conduct that would require any kind of FBI engagement. And so our goal really is to shine as bright of a light on this as possible and work to end the practice. Workers should have a right to use their First Amendment rights without having to worry that they have the FBI or other military industrial giants watching them. People have a right to speak out for change. It's the most basic value of our country. And the fact that a company like Walmart, who, is incredibly powerful. I mean, there are only two things larger on earth than Walmart. One is the U.S. Department of Defense, and the other is the Chinese Liberation Army. I mean, Walmart is a huge player in our economy and a huge player across our globe. And so there's no question that they have power, but our elected officials are supposed to keep a check and balance of, that power. And, our goal will be to make sure that those checks and balances get back in place.
And just quickly, because we're running out of time, is there a good chance as a result of this that those workers that were fired or disciplined would get their jobs back if the National Labor Relations Board finds this to be an unfair labor practice?
Absolutely. I mean, our hope is that our belief is that everything that workers were doing was protected and that what Walmart did was illegal. And so when the judge rules in that way, the remedy would be that workers would be returned back to work and would get back pay for any lost wages as a result of it.
Really, when you're talking about the National Labor Relations Board and it's like unfair labor practice, people are being surveilled by the Joint Terrorism Task Force and Lockheed Martin. My goodness. We have gotten, I wonder when they bring back the Pinkertons. Just in the seconds left, where does our Walmart go from here? Because they will not be daunted, and we have to be very vigilant about all this and support our Walmart even more to make sure that our legislators know about this absolute atrocity that is being committed.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to go forward and continue on. The work to change Walmart, there's a lot more to be done, and we just had great work on this past Black Friday with lots and lots of supporters and workers, and, we'll be continuing on into 2016 and looking forward to using the national election to really highlight the issues of Walmart and as well as these issues we're talking about. So the work of our Walmart will continue on, and we're excited for the future.
I'm going to start trailing Alice Walton. Well, anyway, Dan Schladelman, co-director of All Walmart. We want to thank you. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.